Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. May 20th, 2018, episode 133. Good one. I'm Kevin England, and this is the Beekeeper's Corner. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the corner. Come on in. Take a seat and huddle around. I feel a little compelled to start off with a programming note about episode 132, Last Minute Louie. I recognized after a listener sent me a note that there was a problem with the intro and reposted the episode for you. I did listen to that episode prior to putting it out, but when I did, I scrubbed past the intro and listened to a few bits in the local Hive report, the topics, and near the end, it did not catch that the sound in the intro was so bad until a listener tipped me off on Tuesday. If you happen to listen to the show past the intro, you probably discovered that it was only the intro, but a number of folks said they figured the whole episode was rubbish and threw in the towel. Once again, I changed some of the sound mix for the episode. I was playing around with a feature on the intro track called Noise Gate, and inadvertently it was stripping off the sentences where my voice trailed off, and most of what was said was not intelligible. As I said, it's fixed now, and it was a good one. So feel free to give a listen if the moment isn't lost. Kevin moment. Yeah. So early in the episode. My son Brian plays Counter-Strike. It's a bang-bang shoot-em-up video game. He was playing a game and listening to the recordings of people playing the game. And there's a person from Sweden who talked about shooting with the Desert Eagle. Game nomenclature is Deagle. And he used to say, "That's a good one." With the Deagle, but in Swedish terms, it came out as, "It's a good one with the Deagle," something like that. And the joke was, this thing became a meme. Brian would say this all the time around the house, "Good one, good one." And it just stuck. It's one of those things you'll hear in our household. So Sharon, Brian, and I went to a party one time at my brother's house. And this person came up, and he was a friend of my nephew, and he introduced himself to us. All three of us were sitting there in a row. And he said to Sharon, "Hi, my name is Juan." He said to me, "Hi, my name is Juan." And he said to Brian, "Hi, my name is Juan." And we all looked at each other after spending all this time going, "Good one," laughing internally. And then he proceeded to go around to everybody at the party saying, "Hi, my name is Juan." Well, when he was away from us, we were all like, "Good one! That's just wonderful." Anyway, hence, you now know the reason for the episode. But as I said, the episode is fixed now, and it was a good one. So feel free to give it a listen. See, it still cracks me up if the moment isn't lost. All right. So what's been going on? Let me count the ways. Rain, and more rain. It's just been crazy this week. So yesterday, happily enough, I participated in the Villages in Partnership Water Walk. And, yep, it rained. The Water Walk fundraiser raises funds for the VIP operation so that they can continue their work in Malawi, Africa. And if you're a listener of the show, then you don't need me to go any further in describing that any longer. And perhaps if I have time later in the episode, I'll talk a little bit about that program. The weather's been miserable, and so I've been an inside body over the last week or so. It wasn't until today that the weather finally broke, and I literally just came in from outside working bees, and I was soaking wet, sweaty. It's hot. 80 degrees today, 85 on my car thermometer. And, I was going to say something, but I won't. The weather's been miserable But today was finally the day to break and do some bee stuff. So I'll speak a little bit about what I've been up to during the rain period. And, okay, let me tell you what else is going to happen in this episode. Topic number one, spritzing. Is using sugar water to tame the bees as good as smoke? Topic number two, shaken. Bob Kloss and I had a conversation I recorded yesterday on the way to the water walk on shook swarms. For the round table, a recap of using honey in a novel way to treat turtle injuries. Before time runs out, I want to tell you about yellow jacket traps. I saw a bee watering rig that I thought you might like hearing about. I'll speak of my latest Kevcoction, my large-scale solar wax melter I just finished, one of the internal projects. After that, we'll see where we are on time, and if there's room, we'll look to squeeze in a few other odds and ends. And that being said, I'll share my email, kevin@bkcorner.com, if you have something on your mind and want to ask. Write in. I'll see what I can do to get you an answer. Okay, let's go ahead and head into the local hive report. For the local hive report, I actually recorded my workings of the hive, and I think what I'm going to do is somewhere during the week, I'm going to put them all together and just release them as a sidebar episode. I think it'll be interesting if you just listen to me meander as I'm doing my hive inspections, but let me be more specific about what's been going on. My task plan today, I made one before I went outside. And let me talk about this. I literally went through and said, what are all the things I need to do? I made a bullet list with a checkbox next to it, and I made a list of the equipment that I needed for each of the things. And then after I thought through everything that I wanted, I reorganized the list in the order of precedence, and I'm going to run it through, and it'll tell you what I did today. And then I'll backtrack and tell you what happened over the last 2 weeks. I guess I could start with over the last 2 weeks. I had a solar wax melter. I don't know if I've talked about this on the program. I think I did. One of the problems I had with it was that I made it out of a double pane glass. These are two windows that I found along the road that I was going to make a hive out of, but they were too big and they weren't going to work. I wanted to make a hive that you could see through to the bees. I ended up using it for the top of the solar wax melter. So I broke the inside window out carefully and with no hazard, thankfully. And then I sanded, painted, and took care of the box, got it all prepped. So this thing's just a box with a glass on top. Inside I put a shelf and, as I think about it, I have talked about this. I did a little bit more work. I had this piece of tin out in the yard. And for a while, I couldn't remember what it was for, but I finally figured it out. It's a device that you put underneath a water heater, and it has tall sides, about 6 inches. And if the water heater leaks for any reason, it contains the water and keeps it from running all over the place. Well, somebody had repurposed this thing and was using it outside in my property before I bought it. And I repurposed it and cut it up and made it the inner shelf to lay the tray that is for the solar wax melter. So this is the Kevcoction part of it. There was a time when I had a wheelchair. I was talking about using it for hive transport. But what I found is wheelchair wheels are not really that good for rolling around, especially in the grass. So I repurposed it and mounted this box on it. And it's perfect. I'm able to angle the box down so that when the sun hits the box and the heat generates enough to melt the wax, it runs down the chute and goes into the pan, which is level out in the front. Anyway, it rolls around and it's perfect. I was going to put it on a wagon, but the wagon just wasn't going to cut it. It wasn't robust enough. This wheelchair has been hanging around in the garage since probably the 80s. I have no idea where it came from, and you wouldn't use it as a wheelchair. Although when I looked at it, it was pretty well built. It's perfect. Somewhere along the line, I'll have to post a picture of this thing. The second thing I wanted to do was go out and see if there were any queen cells that I could harvest from my hive. There's only a certain period of time in a year for this to happen, and if you miss it, you miss it. It looks like it's not time yet. When I looked at all the hives, I looked in the Citizen Hive, the Gateway Hive, the Poly Hive, and Hive number 12. I got to check the inventory of these hives while I was in them today. On the Gateway Hive, I switched the hive. All the brood was up in the top, the bottom box was empty, and they were occupying somewhat in the middle. So I did a spring reversal. It's a little bit late, but actually, if you think about our timing, it was cold up until a couple weeks ago, and then this week it rained all week. There was a lot of population in the box, looked good, and one of the other things that I did with all five of my hives was sprinkle direct fed microbials, DFM. People are going to ask which brand. It's Honey Bee DFM. And it's the brand that is made by the factory Strong Microbials. You know, one of the things I was worried about was, does this stuff expire? And was it in good condition? You use a quarter cup and you sprinkle it across the brood frames, dry, not wet. And the shelf life for this says that it will expire on April 11th, 2021. So I'm pretty good there. One of the things I wanted to do was place a queen castle out on the metal stand. So the other thing that I did last week was finish my queen castles. I have two of them that I've made in the past, and I put the false bottom in them so that if you put a frame with queen cells, they'll be able to hang down below. I just winged how deep it should be. I was trying to debate whether I should do something with ventilation for each of the chambers, and what I ended up doing was, because I had to put the shim underneath both of them, I took the solid bottom board off that I had and put a screen bottom board, so both of them have screens. Let's put a pin in that because that's going to become important in a few minutes. I got a replacement broodminder cell. The last one that they tried to send me got lost in the mail, so they had to claim insurance. Well, the new one arrived, and I placed it out and got it hooked up. And hopefully, I didn't check, I just did this a little bit ago. Hopefully, it's doing the readings and doing its thing. I did sync the broodminder before I did it, but I haven't had a chance to look at the data because I'm a one-armed paper hanger today. I started to prep yard one pads. This is probably the biggest thing that I did today. On the last episode, if you listened to it, you heard me talk about digging pads. I have three pads prepped now and moved all the concrete blocks from where they were in the yard and have them set up and everything's level and they got a little tilt forward and life is good. Pretty excited about that when I stand back and look at it. And yes, I have dirt under my fingernails. I was going to move two hives today from yard two. So my design was that I was going to put all my Langstroth-style hives in yard one, which is just a section along the edge of my property. I have yard one, and then I have woods. I have a little opening where the Waray hive is, and then I have woods. And then I have, up towards the front of the property, a cleared area where I have yard two. So I didn't get to that. It was too ambitious, and I went in hive number 12. We had talked about, Sharon and I, every time we go over to yard number two, we get accosted. We weren't quite sure what that was about. Well, I'm pretty confident hive number 12 is too feisty. So one of the things we're going to do is requeen that hive. When I opened it, it was a beautiful day today for going in hives. The sun was shining by the time I was in there. This hive just was not happy at all, buzzing me. And every time we walk out there, it's a little nasty. So, yeah, when queens come a-calling, that hive is going to get requeened. That's just the way it's going to be. So last week, Bob Kloss and I picked a day, and we did queen rearing. I have an episode coming up where I recorded what we did, and we also shot a video feature of this, and I'll have that available in time when I get a chance to produce it. That being the case, we had some queens available. Bob called me this afternoon and said, "Hey, I have a queen. Do you want one?" And I drove over to his home, got the queen in the cage, pulled two frames out of the polystyrene hive, and put them in the queen castle, which has three frames in the chamber, and then loaded in the queen. That's one of the last things I just did tonight. The other thing is Bob gave me a little bit of swarm commander spray. And I have a couple hives that didn't make it through, so I sprayed each one of them in hopes that maybe this is the week swarms are going to come aplenty, and perhaps I can get a couple swarms to load in the box. Bob was telling me that today he had one of his top bar hives load in, and how nice is that? I looked at the hive, and it looks like it's always been there. So that was really, really cool. The other thing that I did this week, just for the record, I finished the paint job on the... Yeah, thank Kevin. I had a top bar. I cut it up. It was too long. I made it smaller. And because I did, I replaced some of the wood and I rebuilt the roof on it. I didn't like it. And when I did that, it had to get painted. So I painted that. I painted the solar wax melter box, and I built a roof for a new hive that I had. I've talked about this before. I purchased this end up furniture end table because I thought after seeing it would make a really cool hive, and I made a hive out of it, and it is really cool. And I had to make a roof, and I finished the roof and painted that. So now both of my top bars, my Lyons Hive Nuke, and a couple other hives are ready to go. And it's split season, so I'm going to try to see what we could do about getting bees in it. Sharon took the little garden hive that we got and put some clear on that. And the other thing that I did this week, I told you I was ambitious while it was raining. The two boxes came that I ordered for my Waré hive, and I painted those and got them prepped. And one of the other manipulations that I did today was I undersupered the Waré hive. So when you use a Waré hive, a lot of people have one of those. Well, a lot of people, I don't know if a lot of people do. I've seen videos of this. It's how it's supposed to be done. You have one of those elevator things that you crank up, and it lifts the boxes, and you put it underneath. Well, Kevin's elevator is Kevin. So what's neat about this hive is that it's not really that heavy. I was able to get my hive tool in underneath between the bottom board and the bottom box, and I could pick the whole hive up and put it down. I put the new box underneath it, and then I put the stack back together. Now, I would have loved to just say I was done, but I wanted to put direct fed microbials on it, so I broke the box out and sprinkled those. But what I learned is I don't have to, like a Langstroth box, keep popping them off. And the top three boxes are loaded full, but they're only eight frames, so you can do this. Did I say that hive is doing really, really well? I had a debate of whether I was going to put two boxes on that hive. I put the first one underneath, and I thought, when you buy that hive, it comes with a ring, and the ring has a notch in it, and the point of the notch is that you could take a queen cage and stick it in the notch. It's a very thoughtful part of the packaging to release your queen. I'm thinking that thing is just like an Emery shim, and maybe, just maybe, I'm going to let them start building out that bottom box, and when they get partway through, I'm going to go up to the top of the hive, crack off that thing, and put in that Emery-like shim and the new box up top and see if they'll build me comb and put honey up in there. This hive is going, and folks, 'tis the season. Every plant, every tree, everything is in bloom. Now, we lost a week, and Bob and I were talking about this. This sucks. It sucks, this rain that we just had last week, and it's supposed to rain this week coming up. There's only about 8 weeks of good forage in the spring. And when it rains like this, it's just not worthwhile. Now, there were periods of time when I walked out in the rain. I went out to go get the box for the Queen Castle was actually deployed. It's just a regular box with grooves cut in it so you could put little shims in the middle. And I had it deployed on one of the hives. So I went out to yard number 2 to get it. And the bees were flying in the rain. I was kind of surprised at that. So, yeah, they did fly, but what they were doing, I have no idea, because when the plants are wet, I don't think they could do it. And it rained and poured and rained, and it's been pretty, pretty wet. Anyway, a couple other things took place today, but I'm running a little long here for a local hive report. That's a lot that's been going on. And like I said, I recorded each of the inspections that I did and just observations, and I did go through one of the boxes and so on one of the hives. So, yeah, I think just if you ever wanted to hear what it sounds like, I've done that in the past. I haven't done it for a while. And since I had my phone, I put it on record and let it go. So I might post that separately and just give it an explanation and let it roll. Local hive report, check. Let's go ahead and move to topic number one. Topic number one, I call this one spritzing. I'm subscribed to an email summary of BeeSource topics. A recent topic about foregoing a smoker and using sprays instead of smoke came through in a thread. I've never tried this, but I always wondered about the plausibility of this. One quick thought is there any real benefits to switching? Why not just use a smoker? And, you know, the common sentiment from beekeepers is, we've been using smoker for a millennia. Why would you ever do anything else? Well, I'm here to say, as I research the topic, there's a lot of interesting points to consider. I guess in a roundabout way, one simple benefit is there's no need to light a smoker. Now, honestly, I don't know what the big deal is about lighting a smoker, but then again, sometimes, no matter how experienced you are, smokers go out or fuel burns up and you don't have any, and having something available. If a smoker goes out and you have just a little more to do, you buy a bigger smoker. Seriously, what if one could reach for a spray bottle with a couple spritzes and finish the job? Sometimes you'll find yourself out somewhere and you don't want to put a smoker in your car. We do county fairs and other outreach events with our bee cage, and you know, lighting the smoker is not advantageous in some of those situations. There are also years and places in the world where a smoker provides a real fire danger in avoiding maybe a practical matter. It's funny, is earlier before it rained like crazy, we were getting weather notices that it was a higher fire danger day. So yeah, there's times I could think of that using something other than a smoker might make sense. But then again, there are some conditions where I think you may not want to use spray. An obvious condition is when it's cold out. You would not want to spray bees and chill the hive. And when it's been raining like it has been, one of the things you don't want to do is add even more moisture problems. Kevin moment. Today, I noticed something, and I'll ask you to pay attention to this. It rained probably the last 6, 7, 8 days, something like that. I noticed the woodenware was wet today, and I noticed some puddling in the hive. On one hive, I saw water standing on a top bar and on a roof, even though the hive was tilted up and had a stick to allow for ventilation. And wood just felt wet, like the inside of the inner covers felt like swollen wet wood. Interesting, no? I don't think it's a problem, but it was just an observation, end of Kevin moment. In Malawi, Africa, that I came back from in March, They harvested honey, and they were not terribly shy about taking honey that was ripe in the comb but not capped. The result was their honey had a smoky overtone, as I shared in the past. What if they used sugar water? Perhaps it might have changed the dynamic? It could have introduced more moisture in the hive, which is not ideal for them because it was really, really humid there. But perhaps they could use some judicious spraying. And truth be told, their bees were so agitated that smoke didn't seem to work. And in this case, perhaps the better way was to spray the bees to keep them from flying, and not so much about trying to control them. I've seen recommendation for something people don't do much of, which is making comb honey. Honeycomb is lipophilic, which means it's a simple concept. It has a lot of fats and it absorbs odors readily. If you're a producer of comb honey, where honeycomb is your product, you do not want to have smoky aftertaste there. In this case, spritzing is likely a way of life. Or you just don't smoke at all, and you suit up like an alien. Another thought about spritzing not a good idea is the idea of robbing. I cannot see, no matter how warm the temperature is, spraying sugar water all over the place during a dearth. That seems like a recipe for trouble. I'm sure if I mold this over, I can come up with other pros and cons, but I want to switch to talking about mechanics. So a spritzer to spray the bees, how might you go about that? Is it water? Is it water with sugar, a sugar solution? Sugar or no sugar? Interesting thought. What about a scent? Use it or not? And how much? Some suggest that a scent can act much like smoke and mask alarm pheromone, so perhaps some peppermint mixed in. Water, and especially sugar water, will form mold. One might consider something to inhibit mold in your little spritzer, and then the spray could be left primed in your kit for inspections. A cap full of bleach to a spray bottle of spritz? Maybe that's too much, I don't know. I've not done this, but it seems like an idea to consider. I think about water and feeding, something I do have experience with. There's the Goldilocks principle. It applies to many things in life, by the way. And sugar solution feeding adheres somewhat to that paradigm. Water can be too cold. Bees won't take it. It could be just right, or perhaps it could even get too hot. In the case of spraying bees from a spritzer, do you have to consider the temperature of the liquid coming from the nozzle? Is it too cold, too hot, or just right? I can imagine that you could possibly aggravate bees if what you're doing is not quite right. In fact, I've read in the past that honey hunters have a range recommendation for temperature that is 77 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Or for our other worldly folks, 25 to 32 degrees Celsius. That makes sense to me. As we know, brood is maintained around 90-ish, and you certainly don't want to be spraying them anything less than 77 and chill them. I start to think about other deltas between smoke and spritz. Started our journey many times by smoking the entrance of the hive. Upon doing so, we hear that familiar little response buzz that indicates the bees are fanning and have somewhat been put on notice. With water, do you spritz the entrance? If it's just water, why would that make any difference whatsoever? Because you're smoking the entrance to prevent the alarm pheromone. But if the water was scented, does the excess water in use make it even harder for the bees to control humidity and moisture in a colony? I don't know how much people use, but I know a lot of people use a lot of smoke, and if you use a lot of water in spritzing, And then you close up the hive and lead them inside the box. And if it's humid and hot out, Kevin moment, thought just popped into my head. What if liquid smoke? I can only imagine that upon vaporization of the water, the smoke volatiles may come out just as if you had used real smoke. That's an interesting idea. End of Kevin moment. Could spritzing lead to more honey production? Huh? Let me muse about an observation. Smoke a hive, and then dig into the frames, and you will invariably, see bees head in, consuming honey. You have to have seen this. Anytime you've ever smoked and then pulled a frame out, the bees are all in their honey. We always describe this as an attribute of, and this is an anecdotal description of what bees are doing. We describe it in this way. Bees think the forest is on fire, and they'll take in food by instinct in case they have to leave and find a new home. In doing that, they wouldn't be left without food while fleeing, and they would be best prepared. I'm never really sure whether that anecdote has any truth to it, but I'll assure you that when you smoke a hive, bees fill up their honey crop. If you spritz and don't smoke, do they eat? That's a trivial savings of resources, but you know, I can't imagine that bees are very productive after they eat that honey. And then they have to replace everything, and you know how expensive it is for them to go out and get honey. I guess I'm covering all the thoughts about Delta, so, you know, give me a little latitude here. There are times when a smoker is advantageous, and there are times when it is not. One small tip for avoiding harming bees is to give a puff of smoke prior to using your hive tool to pry. Have you done this? If you're a new beekeeper, hopefully you know this little tip. When you take a box off and you go to put your hive tool in, you give a little puff of smoke and the bees clear that area and you don't get any. You don't crush them with your hive tool. You don't have to shoo them out of the way. The same principle of moving bees with smoke works against you in some instances. Perhaps you're looking to get to your queen and you've smoked a hive and you've driven her underground. I don't know if you spritz a corner, will the bees leave? Let's talk about scent options for a moment. Lavender is supposed to be calming for humans, but does it calm bees? Who knows? Hey, wait, don't send me hate mail. There's probably a study somewhere that answers that. I'm just using this example illustratively. It's funny, oh, that's stupid. Bees are said to be attracted to anise, but they do not like clove. So one question about scenting water is, are you trying to attract and occupy the bees or repel them from something? We were just talking about spraying the area to clear. If you spray something with clove essence in it, do the bees move away from that area? And how long does it stay in the hive, and do they never go back to that area again? And, you know, incidentally, these questions about anise and clove and lavender, it's why I never have been able to give any guidance on essential oils. It all seems like snake oil to me, and I can't find any credible source that I have definitive conclusions about mix-ins for beekeeping, and you're trying to emulsify and all that other stuff. Now, I know there's tons of information out there for human beings, but the real information for bees, not so good a lot. So don't take that as, I don't think there's opportunities for essential oils. Take that as, I'm conservative on the topic, and I have yet to find a resource I'll trust that will tell me to use X in Y manner, and you'll accomplish Z. With the exception of Honeybee Healthy, I've yet to find a researcher that will tell me that essential oils are something that we should be feeding or administering bees with. And most times, researchers will tell you Yeah, you got to be careful with that stuff. It screws up the scent thing inside the hives. And it has a lot to do with bee biology. If it's not evident, the entire hive and colony existence runs on signals from scents. Queen substance and other pheromones are the glue that holds it together. And while smoke is temporary, anything that is volatile has the opportunity to disrupt. I have to use smoke, but I don't have to use essential oil, so I avoid them. That comes to the statement about spritz. Is sugar solution enough? Perhaps this line of thinking is, to a conservative person, if you're going to spritz, stay generic. Don't mix things in that you have no idea how it's going to impact your hive. I'm not prescribing anything. I'm just letting my inner voice come out here. Let me go one step further. Further. Tired, but I'm going to plow through this, folks. So hang in there with my little faux pas. Water, plain water, or sugar solution. If you're spraying sugar in the hive, could there be a downside? We talked about robbing, obvious potential. I said something about adding bleach to the concoction to inhibit mold if you planned on leaving your sugar solution in your kit for future adventures. What if you don't add bleach and then you simply just spray sugar and water into the hive? You probably have to mix the solution every time, because if you leave it out in the warm days when you work bees, it's going to grow mold. And that's going to clog the nozzle, and that's going to be kind of gross. So if you have to mix sugar water every time, isn't that the same as lighting a smoker? Just saying. And what about the ecosystem inside the hive, the flora and fauna of things? What feeds on sugar besides bees? Yeasts, microbes, ants, and other things. Is an excess sugar solution coating on the inside of your hive surfaces actually a detriment? Sticky hives and beekeepers are not something we wish to deal with. What if you do add bleach to inhibit microbes in your spritz bottle? Does that impact the beneficial microbe as you're spraying it around inside your hive? And you're spraying bleach, if you get a little carried away, what about your honey? Does it pick up a bleach aftertaste? I simply think of it this way. I always ask myself, if the bees didn't put it in there, should I? So with all this being said, pros and cons, I think I still might consider it, placing a sprayer in my kit this year and seeing if there's opportunities where I would reach for it. I think that in certain situations, it could lend themselves to a spritz. So case in point, tonight, I went to pull two frames and I had to light the smoker. I'm wondering if I could have gotten away with a spritz. It actually came to mind today when I was doing it. I'm on the cusp of putting my top bar hives back in service, and I think they are ideal for spritzing, and here's why. When you take the roof off, all the bars are tight together, no bees get out. If you start at one end and you spritz and you work your way through, it might be a really good circumstance. And in fact, what you find a lot of times is people who do natural beekeeping and work these type of hives, they do recommend spritzing. I guess from a conclusion standpoint, I think there are times when it makes sense, but you have to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis. But 9 times out of 10, smoke serves a purpose, and it has been used successfully, like I said, for millennia. I would never consider going cold turkey and just using spritz, and I would never go in a hive without something. Smoke is simply too effective to even consider the notion of not using it. I do think that it has its place for those who know how to work it, spritzing, but I think Michael Bush sums it up best. Michael Bush, a well-known beekeeper, and who I consider pretty informed, says, quote, things I've tried, sugar water with essential oils, water with liquid smoke, Fabi spray, which he says is some European stuff that's in an aerosol can. None of them works as well as smoke, end quote. That's some sage wisdom. Spritz. Yeah. Okay, that's that. Let's go ahead and move to topic two. Topic number two, I call this one Shaken. I named this segment after the Eddie Money song from the 80s. Just chicken. Oh. Yeah, a little Kevin musical Tourette's there. I simply can't help myself, and not one of my shining singing moments. Kevin moment. Perhaps the song is not appropriate for the typical beekeeping audience. It's a thinly veiled song that Eddie put out about a romp with Roseanne. But seriously, the video is a classic. An 80s band simply belting out a tune with some cool cars at a drag race. Yeah, what's not to love about that? End of Kevin moment. Anyway, Shaken in beekeeping nomenclature. Thinly veiled notion that conveys to me the technique of a shook swarm. I think the best ever discussion about one of these that you'll hear us allude to in the conversation I'm about to play you. The conversation between Tracy and Paul from the Beehive Jive podcast. In their episode 2, titled Oops, We Did It Again, they had about a 10-minute overview of what it is and how to do one, and it was, as they say across the pond, brilliant for us Yanks who are not versed to the topic. BeehiveJive.com podcast link from the menu. Scroll down to podcast number 2. So Bob and I discussed the topic and we bounce ideas off of each other. And I was curious to hear Bob's description of a shook swarm. And of course, when we talk, we often exchange ideas and notions. So before I play this, let me give a disclaimer on the audio. I have a Kinvio hands-free wireless Bluetooth microphone in my RAV4. My vehicle is a trusty 2006 model, and while I'm probably not far from trading it out, it doesn't owe me anything, so I keep it going, and I'm trying to hit 200K on it. It doesn't have built-in Bluetooth like SUVs nowadays, and so I have a little microphone, and what you hear is Bob and I passing it back and forth as we're talking, so that it chose this route for this recording. Because in the past, I used to just park the iPhone and hit record, and it would pick up road noise and other things, including the GPS. But in this case, it was raining really heavy the whole time we were going down there, and you could hear the windshield wiper scrub every once in a while. And I thought it was better if we just passed this thing around. So with disclaimer out of the way, let me go ahead and play this for you. And then when it's done, I'll come back and offer some closing comments on it before I move along.
It's May 19th, 4 p.m. in the afternoon. We're driving through the town of Ringo's. Coming up near Mom's Restaurant. Town of Ringo's is a neat little place. It's got a church or two. It's got Mom's Restaurant, Carousel Deli, Firehouse, and that's it. There's nothing else here. There's a Northfield Bank in the Ringo's Deli, too.
Don't forget the post office.
And over there on the corner, across the street where I used to live, is the post office. And then you're out of town. That's all there is to Ringo's. So Bob Kloss and I are driving to the water walk, and I wanted to ask him, he was talking about a shook swarm, and that Roger Garris does these, and I want to know what it is. So I'm going to give the microphone, and Bob's going to explain this to me, even though I've heard what this is and I've heard it, but I want to hear Bob's version of it. So here we go.
So my understanding of this is the real use of it is to get the bees to draw nice new wax. So what you do is you take your hive in the spring and find the queen. You put the queen in the box and you shake all the bees onto foundation and they draw a brand new comb. So I think that's mostly what it's used for from everything that I read. But you can also use it to populate a top bar hive with, say, a Langstroth. So you have a Langstroth hive that's two boxes deep, and you locate the queen, you put the queen in the top bar, and then you just shake all the rest of the bees into the top bar, and that's how you get it started. Now, my concern with it is that they would abscond. You know, they might not like it. You know, all of a sudden you put them in some place, there's no brood, there's no food, there's no comb. So, but if you think about it, it's not much different than a package, right?
Right.
So what I did with Nancy yesterday, so we did a shift swarm because her hive was about to swarm, had close to 20 swarm cells in there, and a couple of them that I showed you that have already hatched. So anyway, we did a shook swarm into the tree hive that she wanted to get going. And then, just to be a little bit, hedge my bets a little bit, I put a frame with brood and a queen cell into the log hive. So this way, if they needed a queen, they could make one, and the brood hopefully will hold them there.
So how did you do that? By the way, we're passing a microphone back and forth so we record better. How? Her log hive is just a log, right? Is there anything in it?
No, there's nothing in it, but the top is uneven, Kevin. It hasn't been cut square across, so there's a little lip on one side, and that gives enough space that I could put a top bar from her top bar hive with the drawn comb right in there. It fit really well. So right now her tree hive is it's a little drafty. It's got a little room in the front that needs to be plugged up at the bottom. And the top, I'm going to go over there with my electric chainsaw and just level it out for her sometime this week. So there's a little gap at the top also where bees could come and go.
So you saw in my garage I have hives in waiting. And what started us on this conversation is I have two top bars, and if I don't get them building now during the actual season, they're going to be done. They'll never finish, I think. You know, I may have to feed them and all that other stuff, but even then, right now is when I want to get them started. So you said in a shook swarm, I'm assuming you take a brand new box and you put foundation frames in it and you shake an existing colony on the foundation, and then you take what was the old box away. And in Europe, they do this to recycle the comb, so they don't reuse the comb. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's to refresh the comb so that they're not using it for more than 4 or 5 years at a time.
But in this case, that's a full purge, right? Or do they leave any of their comb left?
No, that's a full purge. The only thing I'm missing, the point I might be missing, Kevin, is do they do it for swarm control? In other words, do they wait until they see indications that the hive is about to swarm? Because then they would be in a state where they're ready to draw comb, right? So it might work better if that's when you do it. But I'm not sure, because it's not very common over here in the U.S. The only place I've ever seen it is on the beehive jive. They talk about it quite a bit.
I would think that when in Rome, right, if you put a full colony on foundation, if they didn't abscond, they would immediately get to work at building. They have to have the right size, right age bees, right? So you have to do this at a time when there's a nectar flow, is my guess.
Yeah, I would think so, too, because you need those, 12-day-old wax builder bees. The other thing that I tried to do last night that didn't work is I wanted to put a queen excluder on the entrance so that she couldn't leave. You know, just, again, just hedge my bets a little bit more. If they decided they wanted to abscond, that she wouldn't be able to get out. But the hive is so porous, it's got gaps at the top, it's got gaps at the bottom, that it wouldn't have made any difference whether I covered it with a queen excluder or not. So we just rolled the dice, took a chance. We'll see. The other good thing is it's been raining for a week here, right?
Yeah.
Raining like hell today, poured. So the bees aren't leaving that log. The longer they stay in there, the more it feels like home. So I think that's a good thing, too.
I was in the garage today before you came. prepping my queen castles, I was walking with Jim Schmalz this week, and he mentioned something to me about he didn't build his queen castles right because he didn't build a buffer at the bottom for the queen cells to hang. And I thought, oh, I didn't either. And I had nailed, stapled my boxes to a bottom board. And the other thing is I had solid bottom board. And I didn't want to drill holes for ventilation and have to put screen and all that. So I tore my queen castles apart. Well, one thing I'll say to you is, even though it was raining today, I was pressed for having a box. So I took the slides out of the queen castle, and I put that box in service. I don't know if you remember, when you go to my first yard, there was a hole in the handhold from cutting the grooves for the, right?
Yes.
So.
That was one that we made together.
Right. So I went out and got that box today. Well, they were flying in the rain. I was surprised. Both my hives over there were flying. But anyway, I added the spacer on the bottom and switched them to screen bottom boards so they'll ventilate. And, of course, when I did that, the spacers weren't deep enough. They didn't, you know, you got to leave it so that the bees can't go over the spacer and come down into the next chamber. So I had to fuss an engineer. But they're deeper, right? And the dividers don't work. So, but now I have queen castles, and, you know, all in anticipation of next weekend, hopefully, or this week maybe, doing divides and going out and getting queen, you know, getting some stuff going.
So the Shook Swarm was really just one part of the story from last night. Nancy's been calling me and telling me, hey, Bob, the bees are bearding. And I said, well, it's hot, you know, blah, blah, blah. But evidently yesterday her sister Carol actually saw them swarm. And it was the first time she had seen a swarm, so she was amazed.
More excited.
You know, oh, yeah. She just thinks, she's like, wow, I never saw anything like that. But it was a fall swarm, so they all went back, and they were hanging, some of them, on the outside. This is how full the hive was. They were actually clustered on the outside. And I was thinking probably the queen was in there. I don't know for sure. But anyway, that was the first group of bees that I took to put into the Shook Swarm. But then we went through frame by frame, and you should have seen, I've never seen a top bar hive as populous as this. First of all, it's at least 20 bars. Every single one is drawn, and every single one was covered with bees. And not just a few bees, it was covered with bees. And there were a ton of drones. So we went through frame by frame. We were looking for the queen. We didn't see her. But we found 9 frames, 9 out of the 20 frames. I shouldn't say that. I took 9. Then 11 out of the 20 frames had queen swarm cells on them. One of them that I did today had 5 that were usable, 5 queen cells. And there was another one that she kept that was really cool. There was a hole in the middle of the comb. It almost looked like a heart. And they built a queen cell right in the heart. So I said, you have to keep that one. Let them re-queen with it. But so anyway, I took the 9 frames home with me. We left 2 queen cells in the top bar. And I also put a cell in the Shook Swarm in the tree. The other thing that what alarmed me was we also found 2 queen cells, swarm cells, that had hatched side by side. So I'm thinking, well, luckily they didn't go out and kill all these other queens, but it tells me the age of them. You know, the rest of these cells are going to hatch any minute, hour, day. So I took them home, and I'm fretting over what I'm going to do with them, because I knew I was busy all day today. I'm busy all day tomorrow. And if I waited until Monday to try to separate these and to protect them from each other, it would have been too late. So I set up for our first speaking engagement outreach this morning, and then I excused myself. I had a little bit of help, so I excused myself and said, listen, I have to go home. I have got these queen cells. I got to get them in protector cages. So I went out in the pouring rain and did this in my shed in a box just to keep me out of the rain. Went in. But that's the beauty of top wars. You can just, the cells are just so easy to take out of the comb. You can take extra comb with it. So I put them in the, directly into the hair roller cages. What I was going to do was I was going to put them into the JZBZ queen protectors, the little orange ones.
Yeah.
But first of all, they were, because those sit really nicely into the hair roller cages. So I was going to put the actual cell in the JZBZ cage and then put the JZBZ cage, easy for you to say, JZBZ cage into the hair roller. But what I realized was they were too fat. They didn't really fit in the JZBZ protectors. And so part of them was sticking out, and I'm figuring, well, if a virgin wants to come over here and chew a hole and sting through it, she's going to get them, because part of the queen cell was sitting up out of the hair roller. So I just put them directly in the hair roller, and I was able to take enough wax with them that I kind of bent the wax over the top of the hair roller, gave them a little substance. And it took me less than an hour to harvest 14 of them, and I put them back into my top bar nuke, which has 9 frames of bees and brood in it now to keep them nice and warm. And actually, one of the things that I did was I took a piece of tape. You know how much I love blue painter's tape?
Blue tape, yep.
I took blue painter's tape and I laid it sticky side up, and I stuck all the hair rollers on it. And then I took another piece of thinner blue tape and I taped it across the top just to kind of give them some stability in there. And then I was able to lift them 6 at a time and put them into the top bar. So I put them in and put them between 2 of the brood frames, and I closed the upper entrance because I didn't want any drafts. I wanted to make sure they kept them warm. So anyway, that's my story. I'm going to be checking them probably on Monday to see if any hatched. But either way, I suspect that before too long, we're going to have a bunch of virgin queens. So game on.
Yeah, cool. Sounds like you have a lot going on for sure. Thanks for passing that on, and I'll have to consider. I was thinking about doing a shook swarm this year, and maybe I'll have to, I don't know. I got to get in my bees and see what the heck is going on, and then I'll make decisions on where to go from there, you know?
Yeah. I think a shook swarm would be a good way to transfer a Lang nuke into a top bar, right? So I don't know if you had have a nuke that you could use, but I think that would be ideal. Because to shake a whole box of bees in there, first of all, what are you going to do with the comb that's left that's got brood and everything else in it, right?
Yeah.
You know, with a nuke, you got 5 frames, you can find a home for them.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is, you saw, you were just in my garage before we left. I have the little garden hive, it's unconventional. I have the 2 top bars. While they do use Langstroth frames, they're unconventional. I have the tree with all the frames sitting on top, unconventional. So shaking something into something seems like the right way to go, you know?
Yeah, well, I didn't really never thought of it until Roger mentioned it to me. But it makes a lot of sense because, like, for example, the Leyland hive that I made, you know, how are you going to get that started? Well,
I got one of those, too.
He does.
I'm going to have another one.
He does a shook swarm. Well, and then what about our other invention, contraption? So we made these frames. So they're Lang tops, so 19 and a quarter, 19 and a half, whatever they are. But they're double deep. So it's like two deep frames deep. And the idea is you can put 2 empty deep supers and just put this one set of frames up in the top super, and it extends all the way down to the bottom board. I mean, a huge, huge comb. So we supported it in the middle with either wire, or sometimes we used, what do we call them, like a popsicle stake, just so we can support the comb. But they are just massive, because even in the Leyland's hive, they're not as long, but they're not nearly as wide either. Lanes are, what, about 12 inches?
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see whether the bees fill up these things. And if they do, then what? I mean, the only way I can think of harvesting them is, if there's honey in them, is to do crush and strain. Roger says they fit in his 21-frame extractor.
Really?
Yeah, so there must be a way that he can get them in there. But so those are two more examples where a shook swarm would be the way to, you know, get bees in it right away. And to your point, if they have to draw a comb, you've got to get them in early in the year.
Yeah.
You know, we got to do it now. Now's the time. Game on.
Even a week lost is a week lost. You know what I mean? That's what I mean. We're going to go to mid-July, but usually about mid-June, it's about over, right?
Yeah. And who wants to feed them? I mean, yeah, you could feed them all summer and get them to draw more comb, but I don't want to have to do that.
My sense is that when you feed the bees, they don't seem strong enough going into summer. It's not the same as a natural hive that drew itself out. And I almost feel like we're too late already, but I don't know. Are you going to put foundation on those frames, the really long ones? You've not even a foundation starter for them?
No, we put a V-shaped starter strip of wood, but that's it. No, I don't have foundation big enough. I guess I'd have to cobble two deeps together, right?
No, all you need is a sheet to start, right, at the top, and then they'll draw down the rest of the frame because they have the bars. But I would have given them something.
Yeah, well, hey, live and learn.
Still can, right?
Yeah, we can. I can.
No reason why you can't tack some foundation in there, run a couple wires, and support it somehow.
That's true. I could do that. You could even run a little bit of wax on if I wanted to. But so those are two of my playing around hives for this year. I'm really curious to see how the double deep works.
I thought the one thing I would do this week, my one last to-do list, is to build those V-shaped inserts that go into a Langstroth box and let the nuke build over to get me some starter frames for my top bars. Remember that thing I showed you the picture of?
Yeah, that was really cool. How much comb do you have drawn already for the top bars? Any at all?
No, I don't.
Alright. Yeah, so you better get started. Game on.
Yeah, got to get started. That's why I did a full court press to paint them and get them ready. And I'm literally ready to put them out in the yard this week. So, yep. All right, cool.
There were a number of topics in there that I didn't remember us talking about. One of them was Bob was talking about harvesting queen cells drawn out from that top bar hive. I was at his house today. That's where one of the queens came from. He was showing me the queens that he discussed. He had wrapped them with not blue painter's tape as he had recalled, or maybe he changed it. I saw they were wrapped with duct tape. And the key there was he was just trying to wrap the ends of the JZBZ cages so that the other bees could not have access to tear the queen cells down. He said he was messing around with that hive, went through it again, and he found two virgin queens walking around inside the population of bees. And at one point today, he was handling a queen cup that he said were imminent, and one of them popped open, and the queen walked out and walked down his hand. So that's kind of cool. We was talking with Bob about the queens that were going to come out. And as I said, he's going to hand them out to folks and do whatever. His hope is that he's breeding good queens in his yard and he'll be able to distribute the stock. He and I grafted some queens and everything's kind of imminent. It's even going to come this time, this week. So when I went to his house, I left him a queen castle. I had a bunch of frames left over from dead outs that had some resources in them and left him a queen castle because I'm going to be at work this week while all his stuff is hatching. So hopefully that'll work out, and I can get some additional hives from the queen work that we did. So we'll see how that pans out, and I'll keep everybody posted. So let's go to the back of the book, round table number one, Turtle Power. An interesting headline drew me in about a topic for treating turtles with honey, but surprisingly, when I went to find it, I found so much more. The Brevard Zoo in Melbourne, Florida, released a short clip on Twitter that it's been picked up by news agencies. I found it by way of ABC News. It talks about the use of honey from their hives on the property in the zoo in a way to help sea turtles in their care. In following it further, because it was just a short little expose, I watched a tweeted video clip recorded by one of the zoo staff and was so impressed on how they are reaching out to educate the public and share the importance of bees. While espousing the well-known antimicrobial and antibacterial properties of honey, the video clip shows someone treating a turtle, while another zoo person is sharing that honey acts just like a triple antibiotic cream, but it's all natural. While the headline was about turtles, it turns out the video clip from the zoo was as much about the benefits of bees as it was about the products of the hives to treat the sea turtles. Several facts and some guidance was shared in the simple minute and a half video embedded in the tweet. I wanted to know where the zoo was located, so I browsed to their website. It's in Melbourne, Florida, which is on the east coast, directly east of Tampa, which is on the other side of the state. I think it's possible that some future visit to Florida may have to have the consideration to visit this zoo, because my mother-in-law lives in the Tampa area. While browsing the zoo's website, it is evident that their outreach is very present on the website, too, about beekeeping. They have a blog that they chronicle activities at the zoo. This feature, along with many others, had posts specifically about beekeeping and the related activities that they have going on there. The blog post has even more tidbits about bees and expands on the story of the turtles, and that they share that some of the causes of the injuries come by way of the interactions with boats and predators. And there are accompanying pictures and even more facts about the benefits of bees in the written piece that accompanied this Twitter video. Not simply because I'm a beekeeper, but of course it has a little to do with it. I'm impressed. What a great job of outreach from a surprise resource. So clever for them to play off the interaction between turtles and bees as a form to share educational outreach, so kudos to them. It could be noted before I move on from the topic, it appears the beekeeping activities in the zoo are done with partnership with the Brevard Backyard Beekeepers Group. I'm not sure if this is a Florida equivalent of a beekeepers association. Their website seems to portray as much. It somewhat reminds me of the relationship that our friends that the New Jersey Beekeepers Association, Jersey Cape Branch, have with the observation hive that they provide at the Cape May County Zoo. At that zoo, which is free to the public, there are outreach programs and an observation center, and it's all done with a similar partnership. If you ever have the chance, the Cape May Zoo is well worth the visit. For a free zoo hosted by the county of Cape May, it's a pleasant surprise, and they do a fantastic job. I'll have a link to the tweet video and a link back to their website and this particular blog post in my show notes. Roundtable number two, call this one Mellow Yellow. Over the years, we've come to know through experience that yellow jacket wasps are a serious pest to honeybees, especially in the fall. Wouldn't it be nice to do something more proactive and lessen the aspect of the onslaught later this year? In this roundtable, I'm going to share a recent feature presented by Bob Kloss, who you just heard from, to our association, taking an approach to limiting yellow jacket wasps in your apiary. Before I talk about how, let me spend a moment and talk about why. For the most part, yellow jacket wasps are the belligerent jerks of the stinging insect world. When typical people talk about the perils of stinging insects, it could be traced back most times to encounters with yellow jackets. That being said, they do have their place in the world and serve a valuable part of the ecosystem, but that doesn't mean that we beekeepers cannot take measures to lessen their impact to our apiaries. Wasps eat meat. They are not nectar pollen gatherers like our honeybees. However, when push comes to shove, say late fall when there's nothing to eat, they will switch tactics and prey on our bee colonies. Bumblebees, yellow jackets, and paper wasps live in a manner in which only mated females survive over the winter. Survivor queens must establish and begin a nest in the spring. Their first offspring are female worker daughters who take on activities such as nest expansion, foraging, and brood rearing. The overwintered queen is the only one that is laying eggs. In the fall, she lays male eggs and some females that develop reproductive organs so they can be capable of mating. These females will mate while the original queen and the rest of her colony will perish. Of course, as we said, yellow jackets can be a serious pest of honeybee hives. Weak colonies are susceptible, but truth be told, we've seen some big ones go down too. From a timing standpoint, yellow jacket wasps are more likely to attack hives in the late summer, early fall period. They'll attack a honeybee adults and force their way into a hive. Once they're inside, they will sometimes eat bee brood and scavenge it for their young. They're also going to rob some honey, and in extreme occasions, sometimes it means the downfall of your colony, and they even kill the queen in the process. So what to do about this? The proactive approach is pretty simple. Trap them now. All one has to do is leave some homemade wasp traps around the yard to discourage them. Unlike beetle traps, which draw beetles to your property, these capture the ones in the local vicinity, and they're not really a lure, and they don't cause a bigger problem for your hives. I'll describe the simple procedure here and then refer you to the feature video that we captured where Bob was talking, and you can get the details and see what Bob had to say about it. Here's the deal. Drink a few soda bottles, the big ones. Cut the top off the bottle and fill the bottom half with an attractive combination. An old banana peel. The older the banana peel, the better. Brown, gross, smelly. That's what you're aiming for. 1 cup of apple cider vinegar and 4 cups of water. The concoction will entice wasps and other harmful critters, like wax moths, for example, but not honeybees. You take the top off the bottle and invert it, inserting it opening down, and the resultant funnel shape will mean wasps can get in, but they cannot get out. One tip to consider before you assemble is stability. Consider some means of weighing down the container so that you will not see it blown over in the wind. And that's pretty much it. It's a bottle trap with that concoction that I mentioned. So a hive is only effective if you actually put it out. Don't procrastinate. They'll even be more effective if you do this right now, although you could keep them all season long. Now, as we recounted a moment ago, is when nests are being established. Queens are out and they're looking for food. And if you catch some of the queens in your area, well, you'll have less nests and less of the jerks come fall near your apiary. Yellow jackets only fly so far from home base, and the proactive part of this I'm alluding to is this tactic. If you could keep the local nests from forming around your apiary, you'll have less of an onslaught come fall. So that's enough on this topic. But like I stated earlier, there are some additional points that you can glean, and you can see instructions and such if you want more information. Head to youtube.com/NWNJBA and look up yellow jacket traps. There you'll see the video I spoke of earlier, and it has instructions of the recipe and pictures of how to build some of the traps. Roundtable number 3, call this one Water Again. I know, we talked about putting water out on a number of occasions. Still, I wonder how many actually do it. I thought I would do a short one this time on an approach that employs different hardware for watering bees. Saw a Facebook post from New Jersey master beekeeper John Gott on watering bees with a dog waterer and a collection of bio balls. He posted the solution and then shared some insights from users who had a couple of inquiries to his post. And I'm going to sum that up for you here. So the device is a do-it-yourselfer. Buy it on Amazon, turnkey watering solution. Dog watering bottle with a drop tray at the base. The area where the dog would drink from has bio balls. Think of a kid ball pit loaded in the drinking tray. So bio balls are these little plastic ping pong sized balls that are hollow but have a lattice like framework on the outside. They're designed to have a lot of surface area so that when placed in a pond they grow good bacteria and keep different water features stable and healthy. In the case of what we're trying to achieve, a few things work out. They give a place for the bees to land so their feet do not get wet, and they can land and walk down to the water source. They're also black, which helps to heat things up when the sun shines on them, and it makes the water warmer with sun exposure. One of the things John talked about is how he treats the water to make it more nutritious and attractive. He supplements his water with salt, sourced from a pet store. Apparently, marine salt has minerals and trace elements and other things, and he uses 1 teaspoon of salt per gallon. 2018 is the first time that I've had any meaningful success in getting bees to the water I've supplied in my water bucket with floaties in the top. I was looking at that today. It's a little green, but that's actually a good thing because the odor helps the bees find the material. So my property features a stream, our pool, and some other water features that the bees sure enjoy, but most times my bees fly away from our property and I suspect they get the most of their water from the stream down the road. Still, they are using the feeder I just talked about. And we highly encourage you to put a water feature out for the bees, and this idea has some merit. I personally thought self-watering dog bowl and the bio balls make a cool-looking water feature. It's not like ours, which is a bucket sitting in the yard. It looks pleasant, right? And if you have a yard where looks are important, this is something you might consider. So given this is on Facebook, it's only shared with friends of John, and I don't think that I could provide a link to the photo and the Facebook thread, but if I figure it out, I'll provide a link and try to do my best. Roundtable number 4, Water Walk. On Saturday, as I said earlier in the episode, I participated with Bob Kloss and a couple others from our bee team in the Villages in Partnership annual Water Walk. Villages in Partnership is the organization that we went to Africa with back in March to help an outreach program for beekeeping. It's an amazing and hardworking organization. I just come away duly impressed the more and more we hear about what they did, and obviously since we participated in it. The first thing I want to state is thanks to those who donated to our bee team. Our B team raced a little over $3,700 to the grand goal, which is just short of $70,000. And the VIP organization is looking for a target goal of $80,000. So they have $10,000 to go. And they do get donations after the water walk, so they're hoping to still achieve their target. It struck me how immense the size of the undertaking is as they overviewed what they did to the participants. The event went where we met in the church in Allentown, and they introduced all the teams, the people who are principals, and a lot about what they do there and how they do it. This is the 10th year of operation, and they've expanded from 13 to 26 villages. They had a video of the United States, and they popped over to Malawi, and then they went down to the country and the region, and then they showed the highlight of the area of the villages that they serve. In 2018, 2019, they're looking to take on even more villages, which is just amazing. Their willingness to continue to do outreach and expand. 19,000 people are in their partner villages. Think about organizing any activities for that number of people. It's staggering. We, of course, saw firsthand the secondary school that they built, the Sakata School, and they showed pictures during the presentation of the school prior, and it was just ramshackle shacks, and what they have now is amazing in comparison. And then they talked about the clinics that they constructed and the dozens, if not 100-plus water holes, and we saw bridges that they've built and all of that. Oh, man, it's just amazing the amount of work that they're doing. And they're a relatively small group from what I could see. And they just deal with so many problems. It's staggering. Of course, there's poverty and hunger and poor nutrition, lack of clean water or even access to water. But the infrastructure that they help with, people's personal houses where the roofs leak, buildings, electricity, roads, bridges, social issues, theft and other problems that go on. And there's orphans all over there that they try to help and get them to stability. I'm only beginning to list the items that VIP is tackling. Last year, there was a new pest, a weevil in the corn. Maize is such a staple there, and this could be devastating to them. But it's another challenge that VIP is going to take on in the region. As they said, three steps forward, two steps back, but they keep moving forward. And of course, there's beekeeping. The average income of the country is $650 per person a year. Wow, that's just crazy. In teaching beekeeping, in selling honey and products of the hive, the dozens of people that we came in contact with, we could truly change their lives. They could facilitate their kids going to school, which is a challenge because a lot of kids have to stay home so that they can eat and farm because that's how most of them make their living. They're subsistence farmers. And some of them even make their way to university. And a lot of them, I'm guessing, study agriculture and come back and help the community. With becoming a beekeeper, they could do things like improve their living condition. It's not simple to be a beekeeper there, but it is doable. And the ability to keep bees takes on a whole new meaning. And they don't do it there as a hobby. It's literally about survival. That means you have so much more skin in the game, and simple improvements can make a big difference to success. With that perspective, I think our bee team is making some small impacts, but families, communities, and anyone around the beekeepers can benefit. And they simply help each other. That is such a spirit of the people there. They help each other. If there isn't a more poignant case of beekeepers going together, I can't think of one. It's never fun to ask for money. It's just something I absolutely hate to do. But in this case, I think it's warranted to say, if you're moved by this, waterwalk.com www.villagesinpartnership.org. You can go there and donate if you choose to do so. And again, for anybody who did donate, thank you. I feel the same way about the donations that I get for my personal program. I truly appreciate each and every one of them that come through. I see the time in the episode. I prefer to have more short and a bunch of topics, but every show has its own fingerprint, so to speak. I wanted to sneak in a quick listener mail. This one's been sitting here for a while. Hannah R. wrote in about butter honey. It was one of the topics that came out of the microscope meeting conversation from an episode or two back. Professor Vaughn Bryant of Texas A&M is a person who does inspection of pollen for you, and Hannah shared this information. She shared a couple articles, one from Bee Culture that talked about filtering honey, one that talked about the way that they identify honey and the dynamics of that. And she shared that Dr. Vaughn will scan your pollen and tell you what kind of honey you have. And there's a service provided by Texas A&M. It's interesting, the honey processing and analysis little piece in the paper that they have, and I'm sure you can go to their website. They tell you how to ship the pollen. They tell you how to how much you need and what they intend to do. I think it's $75 a sample based on the data they sent me. And they have a wet and dry lab and different, you know, obviously it seems like they're experienced at this, so you can achieve what you're looking for there. And I want to say thanks to Hannah for sending that along. I really appreciate that. In fact, I think I'm going to read those articles and see if there's something I can share across, because it's an interesting topic to me. So the weather in New Jersey is finally broke. It's warm enough day and night to do bees. And yes, closing comments go, it's time to get out in the yard. There's so much to do. And I can't believe it's almost June already. We have pretty much a month left of the real season, and then it's back to maintenance mode. And I want to do whatever increases and other things that I have in mind. Bob Kloss and I really enjoyed doing the queen rearing thing, learned a lot from it. And that's what you'll hear next. You'll hear some stuff that we recorded, see some things that we recorded coming out of those sessions. I think we did a really good job recapping our activities, and we recorded for about an hour. What I think I'm going to have to do is go back to Bob at some point and record the aftermath. So we were very, very helpful, but in the end, I know what the results were. We got five queens, and the Nico cage didn't work out so well, and we know why, right? So if at first you don't succeed, try again. The thing I talked about earlier, Bob had harvested a number of queen cells from a top bar, and that'll give us some queens to work with right now. He's got a bunch of people that he works with, and he's going to be distributing queens all over the place. So good for him. I mean, he just constantly gives back to the beekeeping community with his outreach that he does just about every weekend. He's a nut with that stuff with Northwest. Just doing a bang-up job on that. And then he mentors so many different people. And as I talk to him, I know one of the things he knows is that he's learning so much from all the hands-on stuff. And that is going to be invaluable for the EAS Master Beekeepers exam, which of I'm trying to focus and study. So maybe I should be careful about all the stuff I'm producing. One of the things I've been mulling over lately is I never built my Polariscope. And I've been mulling over different designs and trying to figure out how I'm going to put that together. I think I have it pretty much, although I guess when I get out in the workshop, I'll figure that out. So pretty exciting. We have a beekeepers meeting coming up first week of June. For some reason, I think I have a conflict, but that's a field meeting. They're going to do splits and other things, usually our second meeting of the year. Live bees, hopefully the weather will cooperate. And the other thing that's been on my mind lately is EAS is coming up, and Bob and I have been doing our fair share of studying. Bob's got a lot more time than I do. I got 20,000 things going on, and, you know, look, suck it up. I think I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be fine, but Yeah, need to focus on that. Yeah, I think that's all I have to say. I'm rambling. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well. We'll see you soon.